Noi selezioniamo le interviste e le riproponiamo per voi. Riascoltale su unicaradio.it o scaricale. Unica Radio, portala sempre con te.
Thank you very much for that. And I'd also like to say thank you to the organizers for inviting me here. And I should also apologize for my lack of fluency in Italian and many other languages, which I realize is inadequate for a serious study of Gramsci. But as Francesca said, my disciplinary background is in international relations. And as you're probably aware, since the early 1980s, there's been a lot of consideration of Gramsci and how it explains international relations, beginning with a seminal article by Robert Cox, which was really sort of first attempt by an international relations scholar, as I'm aware of, to bring the use of Gramsci in. But I take a slightly different track to that. I'm trying to present the argument here of my recent book, where I propose passive revolution as a theory of state formation in conditions of late development. And of course, by late development, I mean development that takes place late in world historical time, in a context where there are already developed states in existence in the world. And it, to me, it captures the way that the political rule of capital is established in situations where there isn't a strong local bourgeoisie and there's external pressures to develop. So in the book, as we heard, I apply this to try to understand broadly the post-1945 experience in East Asia. But for the purposes of this presentation, I'll focus particularly on my the way I apply this argument to South Korea and Taiwan. So the engagement that I have with the literature, it's quite a mainstream political economy literature, so I won't spend too much time talking about it. But basically, for about four decades, people have been debating the rise of East Asia as a region in the international system. And that debate has, for the most part, revolved around whether it was the market that did it or whether it was the state that did it. And this debate seems to go on and on and on. The market side of that debate really has its origins in the rise of neoliberal ideology at the World Bank from the late 1970s. And so it was World Bank economists who made this argument most forcefully, because they needed countries to show that neoliberal ideology worked, and that if countries followed World Bank prescriptions, then countries could achieve development. And so they needed examples of places where this had worked. So they took Japan and South Korea and Taiwan, and they said that, you know, these were examples of free market economies. They had not pursued import substitution industrialization, and they had adopted market-friendly policies that had allowed those countries to export internationally and not develop inefficient industrial sectors. So this is a very kind of internally coherent theory, but it's also completely wrong, right? Anybody who's ever been to South Korea or Taiwan would know that this is not actually a minimal state, just letting the market do its magic. So the alternative argument to that focused then on the role of the state, which was perhaps more historically accurate. And it showed how the states were actively intervening in the economy by facilitating a very effective form of coordination between the state and capital. Okay, so particularly states in Japan and South Korea and Taiwan, what they did was they partly through ownership of or control over the banking system, they would direct capital into industries that they wanted to, the state wanted to see develop. And then by doing that, they could sort of force the development of particular industries, albeit in a kind of private capital setting, but with a strong directing state. So that was the debate, and that's where I start off. And the second explanation about the state, as I say, is probably a bit more accurate, but the problem with it, well, there's two main problems with it. First of all, this debate, but particularly relating to the state as I speak here, is it neglects the role of the international and focuses almost entirely on domestic institutions, actors, and policy initiatives. It says very little about international history, about the role of the Cold War, the role of the United States, and how that affected why it was that East Asia saw this rapid process of catch-up industrialization after the Second World War, and not other regions. And also, if we focus mainly on domestic institutions, the developmental state, for example, it doesn't tell you very much about why those countries actually started to abandon that approach in the 1990s and made a transition towards a more neoliberal model of development. So that's one kind of lacuna, one absence, if you like, this neglect of the international as a causative field of analysis. But also they neglected the role of domestic society as well. And, again, explaining the transition to neoliberalism in the 1990s, it's very difficult to do that without looking at how the process of rapid industrialization had led to movements of resistance within the countries themselves. How you'd seen the rise of labor in particular, but also of peasant movements, of student movements, and how these were kind of processes that challenged the authoritarian developmental states and led to what I'll go on to explain is actually a new round of passive revolution, if you like, from the 1990s, which is much more in line with the transition to neoliberalism globally. And of course, that failing is related to the sort of neo-Weberian nature of the statist literature, where they kind of assume that state autonomy is just a sort of natural a priori assumption, not as something that is actually produced as a result of the 1945 conjuncture and the imposition of American hegemony. And so the thing that they miss then is an analysis of labor and the rise of labor as a political actor and other social forces, and how this then served to undermine the authoritarian developmental state model. And it's quite surprising that they actually, they neglect this, because when we think about, what is it that facilitated the East Asian countries' a rapid catch-up industrialization was export-oriented industrialization based on politically weak and cheap and exploited labor and the repression of labor movements. And I think this is something much more central to the East Asian experience that is often neglected, at least in the mainstream literature. So I try to use Gramsci's understanding of passive revolution to try to conceptualize this and to capture historically how East Asian political economies, East Asian states, were able to create this kind of state-society relationship where labor was weak and repressed. Now, I think in using Gramsci's concepts, we should always be clear exactly what we mean because of the ambiguities. In the prison notebooks, of course, passive revolution is raised in different places and has slightly different meanings. In the first instance, it's about the absence of the Jacobin movement in Italian history. But then Gramsci goes on to apply to a broader group of countries such as Bismarck's Germany. But then there's also a sense in which Gramsci uses it to describe an entire historical period, which goes roughly from about 1848 and then, of course, up until the time of the writing of the Gramsci's notebooks, up until the rise of fascism in the 1930s. And so it's a period that's broadly contemporaneous with the rise of, you might call, modernity in Europe as a whole, but of course also capturing the way that countries which are industrializing and catching up later, what are their kind of characteristics? And of course, there's two different sort of forms, I think, I would say, of what passive revolution actually is. So if you look at the analysis of the Risorgimento, it's related to how the feudal relations of production are then superseded by capitalism, but this is not, you know, perhaps the format of the French Revolution, but you see an alliance between the bourgeoisie and the old ruling class. But I think there's also another way in which passive revolution is used, which is, you know, much more related to his analysis of the rise of Fordism and the New Deal in the United States, and also how that is reflected elsewhere, for example, in Italy with the rise of fascism. But in this understanding of passive revolution, there's, it's more about the modifications that are made within the existing capitalist relations of production. And it's that second understanding that I'm drawing on. But I think, you know, it's, as I said at the outset, it captures the way that a country's status as a late developer means that, you know, the bourgeoisie is generally weak, and thus the state can play a stronger role in facilitating a kind of revolution from above. So this revolution from above is a way that state power is reorganized, and it reorganizes its relationship to society, but it seeks to preserve the control by the few over the many. This is what Anne Shostak-Sassoon talks about, passive revolution, maintaining a lack of control by the mass of the population through, of course, such techniques as Caesarism and Transformismo. And as I go on, we can see that in terms of establishing the political rule of capital, this has been a particular feature of catch-up industrialization and state formation in East Asia. But of course, this also involves a kind of selective adoption of certain demands that are made by the subaltern classes, but in a way that does not empower them and maintains the dominance of the state. So just to clarify, I started off saying that, you know, this has been, Gramsci's been adopted by international relations theorists, but I would say this is a slightly different approach to people like Robert Cox and the neo-Gramscian IR theorists, who I think were somewhat wrong to try to take Gramsci's analysis of a national setting, Italy, and then apply that globally and say, well, instead of the national state, you have international organizations, and instead of civil society, you have global civil society. So this is a slightly, I think that's problematic, and this is a slightly different approach where I'm, I think it's still, you know, the international dimension is important because it's about state formation as a form of late development. But I think it perhaps has more in common with, for example, Trotsky's understanding of uneven and combined development. And I think there's in the Prison Notebooks and also in Trotsky's introduction to the history of the Russian Revolution, there's some common concerns there with for example, the role of combinations. You know, Gramsci uses the term combinations about how different kind of international influences and how issues related to historical timing lead to a more kind of unique forms of state formation. So that's how I'm trying to do it. So I'll go on then to talk about the South Korean and Taiwanese passive revolutions. So basically in 1945, you saw in both of those countries the establishment of strong anti-communist regimes in partnership with the United States, either in terms of direct military and government, as you saw in South Korea in the late 1940s, or in Taiwan indirectly through the Kuomintang nationalist government. And, you know, 1945 East Asia, there's a lot of kind of revolutionary impetus in society there. It's the post-colonial situation. So much of the passive revolution is about repressing that revolutionary impetus, often through a great deal of simply straightforward coercion. In both countries, you see in the late 1940s and the 1950s a kind of white terror where radical labor organizers and leftist activists are either imprisoned or basically killed. The banning of international, independent labor organizations, and at the same time an attempt to establish kind of state corporatist forms of labor unions, which would encourage the co-optation or transformismo of pro-government labor leaders. Keeping in mind that these countries are both primarily agricultural countries, the land reform is an important part of the passive revolution as well. So it's a reflection of the successful land reforms that had taken place in particularly China and in North Korea, and of course much earlier in the Soviet Union. So a situation in which you had a land to the tiller land reform, which immediately both dissipated the impetus for socialist revolution in the countryside in East Asia, and also in one instance kind of eliminated the landowner class. So after the land reform took place, there was no sort of, you know, political interventions by the landowner classes, because these had been kind of eliminated. So these kind of forms of revolution from above, leaning towards coercion, but also consent, underpins the success of export-oriented industrialization. It explains why those countries were able to pursue export-oriented industrialization and not so much other country, other regions within the global south. Okay, but also the process of industrialization itself leads to a dynamic that you have. You know, it's just as Marx and Engels described in the Communist Manifesto, the process of bringing workers into factories creates first a consciousness, a class consciousness for itself, and the emergence of labor struggles in both Taiwan and South Korea, particularly in the 1970s. It was very much in the sort of sweatshop, you know, textile sectors, you see labor struggles, particularly amongst female workers. In the 1970s, they still did not have the structural power in which to make genuine gains, because it was a very kind of, you know, you still had a large reserve army of labor in the countryside. There was huge labor turnover, and the state was still, because of its strong anti-communist ethos in the context of the Cold War, was able to quite easily repress independent labor organizations. Now, things started to change after the 1970s, partly about geopolitical international transitions, because what you had was, you know, the rise of East Asian industrialism. That began to challenge US manufacturers, and you see increasing global overproduction and these kind of horizontal contradictions of capitalism. And, you know, eventually this led to the rise of global neoliberalism in part after the 1980s. But also, actually, because of this, you get a process of partly increasing relocation of global manufacturing to East Asia, including South Korea and Taiwan. So initially, South Korea and Taiwan didn't do badly out of this. So this is the process that, you know, Giovanni Arrighi has talked about this, is about spatial, this, you know, using Harvey's notion of the spatial fix, about how that leads to increased relocation of production to East Asia. But it's also geopolitical as well. So you had the, you know, as a result of the Vietnam War, you had the Nixon Doctrine, which was about trying to shift the burden of defense onto the Asian countries themselves, reopening of relations with China. And all of this is considered to be a kind of a crisis for the East Asian countries, particularly South Korea and Taiwan, who's you know, strong, you know, on the front line of the Cold War. So they put into process from the 70s and into the 80s a process of heavy and chemical industrialization, which actually served to radically change the economies. And you got the emergence of heavy industry and then labor shortages. But this also played an important role in strengthening the organizational basis of labor. This shift from overwhelming sweatshops and light industry towards heavy industry, where workers had much more structural power, okay? And then you see from the 1980s, more in the way of unrest. Although this is much stronger actually in South Korea than in Taiwan, and I would argue that the nature of the passive revolution in Taiwan was much more complete, and explains why there's still much more in the way of resistance and opposition to the rule of capital in South Korea than there is in Taiwan. Part of that is related to colonial histories and things like that. So the colonial experience in being colonized by Japan for Korea was much more transformative, and it created a legacy of resistance, and including working class resistance, whereas Taiwan was left much I wouldn't say unchanged, but at least not so much in the way of colonial underdevelopment in Taiwan than you see in South Korea. So there's a legacy there. But also the Taiwanese passive revolution much involved kind of displacing notions of class identity with identity politics as well. So if you look at the rise of the labor movement in Taiwan, rather than a class identity, there's much more an identity between the local Taiwanese. They're ethnic Chinese, but those who have been there for much longer, since the 17th and 18th centuries, versus the kind of mainlander Chinese who came in 1949 after the defeat of the Kuomintang. And so identity politics has played a much more important role in Taiwan, and it's constrained the emergence of a kind of class identity, which was not so much the case in South Korea, where there was much more of a, you know, people were reading Marx much more widely, there was much more of an explicit attempt partly by the student movement to develop the labor movement. So anyway, these, by the end of the 1980s then, you get to a certain extent the rise of democracy movements in both countries and a transition to formal democracy. But in the book, I interpret this transition to democracy in the late 1980s as a new or a renewed form of passive revolution, because you know the form of democracy is just formal. Well, it's formal democracy, right? But in many respects, it's combined with a transition towards neoliberal capitalism, and the way that democracy has worked has been to constrain the kind of the resistance mobilized by labor to the neoliberal rule of capital. And I'll explain a little bit how that has happened. So in South Korea, for example, you had the legalization of the labor movement in the 1990s. So the labor movement started to try to participate in kind of social corporatist policy-making institutions in the 1990s, but the form was similar to a kind of social pact policy-making that you might see in Europe, for example. But in reality, because the kind of deals that were made within this social policy pact-making forums was that the government and business would offer legal recognition to the labor movement. But this would be in return for the flexibilization of the labor laws. So you get, under democracy, increasing kind of legal recognition of labor at the same time that you have the massive expansion of the irregular labor force, who tend to be non-unionized. So there's a kind of a paradox there, actually. And similar efforts by the labor movement to establish political parties have also basically failed, because partly because even though you have formal democracy in South Korea, you still have a strongly anti-communist political culture. And in recent years, the mainstream political parties were able to accuse the Korean Labor Party of having links with North Korea, for example, and then use that to ban the party and destroy the political side of the labor movement. In Taiwan, it's not so dissimilar, although in Taiwan, as I said, the stronger influence of identity politics, and again, I mean here by identity politics about whether you subscribe to a view of Taiwanese independence or at some point in the future reunification with China. The Taiwanese independence line is much more dominant, but all unions tend to have a position on this. And so what's happened is rather than interpret manifestations of capitalist exploitation or neoliberalism as capitalism and in a class framework, often it'll be interpreted in the sense of repression by the mainlander Kuomintang and these kind of ethnic differences between the Taiwanese working class. So, for example, just privatization. I mean, normally it might be in South Korea interpreted basically privatization as a negative manifestation of neoliberalism, but in Taiwan, actually, many working class workers organizations, unions supported privatization. The reason is that many of the state-owned enterprises were actually owned directly by the Kuomintang, and so they were seen, privatization was seen as a way of pushing back the influence of the mainlander Kuomintang influence within Taiwan. So, just to finish then, there are differences between the way that passive revolution has worked between South Korea and Taiwan, but nonetheless, I still think we can use the concept as a common understanding of the way that the political rule of capital is established in those countries and how that reflects their status as late developing countries. It's a feature of a strong drive towards catch-up industrialization, and the stronger that drive is, the more this involves the kind of constraining of social forces in that process. So, yes, I think I'll finish there. All right, thank you.
Ringraziamo anche Kevin Gray, ma prima di fare qualsiasi altra riflessione io vorrei invitare appunto i relatori anche della prima sessione qui sopra e anche appunto la chair della prima sessione, così possiamo fare un dibattito in modo che ci sia una appunto discussione anche con i relatori della prima sessione.
Selezioniamo le interviste realizzate e le riproponiamo per voi. Musicisti, innovatori, artisti, sportivi, operatori sociali. Raccontiamo la città che cambia. Un archivio unico a disposizione. Scelti da noi e messi in onda per voi. Unica Radio, B-Podcast.